From their homeland near the Aral Sea, the Turks had built an empire that stretched across mainland Persia and the Middle East, capturing Baghdad and much of the eastern Mediterranean coast. In 1071, the Byzantine emperor Romanos IV Diogenes considered them enough of a threat to march an army of 40,000 soldiers, comprising Byzantine troops and a large contingent of mercenaries, including Turkic soldiers, into Asia, to meet them at a place called Manzikert, in what is now Armenia. The battle was a disaster. Half of Romanos's troops deserted, and he became the first Roman emperor to be captured in battle in 900 years. While casualties of the battle itself were not enormous, this was a devastating blow to the empire's morale. When Emperor Romanos ransomed himself back at the price of 1.5 million gold pieces, the surrender of several cities, and the betrothal of his daughter to a Turkish prince, the embarrassment proved too much for his subjects. He was toppled from power and blinded, later dying from an infection related to his wounds. The 30-year period of civil war and court machinations that followed damaged the Byzantine state far more than their battlefield loss. As Byzantine armies destroyed one another, the Turks happily seized more of their cities, further depriving the empire of the economic base it needed to rebuild. In only a few years, the Byzantines had lost their heartlands in Asia, and their enemies on all sides were emboldened. The historian Anna Komnena, who was the daughter of Emperor Alexios, wrote the following mournful appraisal only a few decades after the battle. The fortunes of the Roman Empire had sunk to their lowest ebb, for the armies of the East were dispersed in all directions because the Turks had overspread and gained command of countries between the Black Sea and the Hellespont, and the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean. Another 11th century Byzantine historian, Michael Attaliotes, strikes an even more moribund tone, writing, "We were pressed on all sides by the bonds of death." For centuries now, despite their differences, Western Europe had relied on the Byzantines to hold back the ambitions of the various Muslim empires that had risen and fallen in Asia. But it was becoming increasingly clear that they couldn't hold out on their own forever. If Byzantium was to remain as a bulwark at the gates of Europe, it would need some radical help. Into this situation strode a militant and ambitious pope named Urban II. Urban was a French noble who had a vision of a new kind of aggressive, expansionist Christianity. For centuries, European pilgrims had travelled to Jerusalem, often passing through Byzantium, crossing the Bosphorus at Constantinople, before heading into Syria and down the coast of the Levant. But Urban had a vision of what he called an armed pilgrimage, a mighty flexing of the military muscles of Western Europe, which would spread fire and death in its wake. Soon, he would get his opportunity. The 11th century Byzantine emperor, Alexios I Komnenos, feared for the future of his empire. In 1093, he was desperate enough to send out a dramatic series of requests for help, heavy with lamentation and full of weeping, begging with tears for the aid of the entire Christian people, as one Byzantine source has it. Alexios even turned to some of the empire's bitterest rivals, the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope, who the Byzantines diminutively referred to as the Bishop of Rome. Alexios had expected perhaps a few regiments of well-equipped Western knights to bolster his beleaguered armies, but he got much, much more than he bargained for. On the 27th of November, 1095, the Pope called together the Council of Clermont and urged all those present to take up arms under the sign of the cross. Urban declared that they would finally recover Jerusalem and the East from the Muslim powers. He also made the bold promise that all those who went to war on his behalf would be forgiven their sins. To the sin-obsessed people of medieval Europe, this offer seemed too good to be true. The response was enormous. Anna Komnena gives one description of the arrival of this horde in her chronicle, The Alexiad. After him came another innumerable heterogeneous crowd, collected from nearly all the Frankish countries, together with their leaders, kings, dukes, counts, and even bishops. One might have likened them to the stars of heaven or the sand poured out along the edge of the sea. This army is thought to have contained more than 100,000 people, a migration made up largely of mobs of poor peasants who had marched across the continent, gathering new recruits and looting in every town they passed through. They had only got as far as the Rhineland when they ran out of provisions and, whipped up in a righteous fury, attacked the sizable Jewish population who lived there, massacring their villages and stealing their food and livestock. But eventually, they did reach the fabled walls of Constantinople. When Emperor Alexios saw this horde gathered outside his city, his blood must have run cold. One particularly unruly group, led by a man named Peter the Hermit, even began looting and burning Byzantine villages near the capital, and Byzantine troops had to be dispatched to restore order. Alexios must have wondered whether it might be wiser to take his chances with the Turks rather than this rabble of Latins. But he decided to make his deal with the devil. He allowed this crusader army to cross the Bosphorus and march into the Holy Land. The crusaders, despite their general lack of experience, equipment, and discipline, did well. They took the city of Nicaea in June 1097 and Antioch a year after that. Jerusalem was taken by assault on the 7th of July 1099, with the crusaders massacring the city's defenders. For the next 200 years, there would be some form of crusader presence in the Eastern Mediterranean and Levant. We shouldn't doubt the crusaders' religious convictions, but these also aligned conveniently with economic and strategic considerations. Just as it had been in the days of Ugarit and the Phoenicians, this stretch of coast was a crucial gateway through which trade goods entered the Mediterranean from the Silk Road. Here, the Latins set up small crusader kingdoms, a kind of early prototype of the settler states that would later characterize European colonialism. And wealth flowed back to Europe through the old Phoenician ports of Acre and Jaffa. Emperor Alexios had bet on the Crusades, and for a period of about two centuries, the gamble paid off. Two subsequent crusader armies passed through Constantinople on their way to the Holy Land, and from 1100 onwards, the five emperors of the Komnenos dynasty presided over a century-long restoration of the military, territorial, economic, and political position of the Byzantine Empire. While their Muslim rivals were busy fighting the constant influx of Latin armies, but the empire was on borrowed time. As the power of the Crusades demonstrated, Western Europe was no longer a distant backwater. It had become a world of its own, with its own tensions, conflicts, and interests. Alexios's deal had unleashed dark forces that would ultimately spiral out of control. This would come to a head during perhaps the most disgraceful campaign ever conducted by a crusading army in the East, the Fourth Crusade. The goal of the Fourth Crusade was similar to those that had come before it, to recapture the Muslim-controlled city of Jerusalem, which had been retaken in 1187 by the Ayyubid dynasty of Saladin. Crusades had always been chaotic, poorly organized affairs, run as a kind of directed anarchy. But the Fourth Crusade set a new standard for chaos. The Crusaders gathered in Venice in the year 1200, but when they arrived, they found they didn't have enough money to pay for their transport onwards to the Holy Land. The Venetians, seeing an opportunity, asked the Crusaders if they would attack one of their rivals, the Catholic city of Zara in modern Croatia, then held by the Christian nation of Hungary. The Crusaders, deciding that anything was justified if it ultimately ended with the recapture of Jerusalem, besieged Zara, sacked it, and burned it to the ground. This act of violence against their fellow Christians shocked Europe, and Pope Innocent III issued an order of excommunication for the whole Crusader army, excoriating their actions in fiery terms. To the counts, barons, and all the Crusaders, without greeting, behold, your gold has turned into base metal, and your silver has almost completely rusted, since, departing from the purity of your plan and turning aside from the path onto the impassable road, you have withdrawn your hand from the plough and looked backward with Lot's wife. For when you should have hastened to the land flowing with milk and honey, you turned away, going astray in the direction of the desert. The army leaders, perhaps wisely, chose not to pass news of their excommunication down to their men. But while many viewed this ungovernable force as a danger and a disgrace to Christendom, others saw in it an opportunity. Alexios IV Angelos was a bitter man. He was the son of a Byzantine emperor, but his father had been deposed in a coup, and now he lived in exile with his brother-in-law, the King of Germany. Alexios had been told all his life that the people of Constantinople waited in anxious anticipation of his return, and he had long been scheming to make this happen. When he heard news of the failing Fourth Crusade, still heavily in debt to the Venetians, running out of money and now wintering in the ruined city of Zara, he saw his chance. Alexios offered the leaders of the Crusade a simple deal. You take the city of Constantinople and put me on its throne, and I will open the treasuries of Byzantium, pay off your debts, and fund the rest of your crusade to Jerusalem. The leaders of the crusade jumped at the opportunity. But even on their journey to the city, they detected signs that Alexios's promises couldn't be relied on, as one crusader leader, Count Hugh of St. Pol, recalls. Sailing from there, then through the strait, we passed by the arm of St. George, 1 league from Constantinople. There we were stunned, very much astonished, that none of the friends or family of the young man who was with us, or any messenger of theirs came to him, who might tell him about the situation in the city. When the Fourth Crusade arrived at Constantinople on the 23rd of June 1203, the metropolis had a population of approximately 500,000. It was defended by a force of 15,000 soldiers, including 5,000 of the famed Varangian Guard, Norse warriors who defended the kings of Byzantium. All those who had never seen Constantinople before gazed very intently upon the city, wrote one crusader, Geoffrey of Villardouin. There was indeed no man so brave and daring that his flesh did not shudder at the sight. When they arrived, they found that the great defensive chain had been drawn across the Golden Horn, blocking access to the port. One side of this chain terminated in the Tower of Galata, across the Golden Horn from the city, and so they determined to seize this tower and break the chain. They landed, charging their horses directly out of their transport ships, and beat back the tower's defenders, mercenary troops of English, Danish, and Italian origin. On the 6th of July, the largest ship in the Crusaders' fleet, the Aquila, smashed through the chain, and the port was opened to their fleet. Next, the Crusaders turned their attention to the city walls. On the 17th of July, they sailed into the Golden Horn and drew their ships up below the sea walls. They swarmed up the masts, scrambling across catwalks to reach the top. Other ships landed on the shoreline, and the Crusaders used picks and shovels to hack away at a gateway that the defenders had hurriedly bricked up. The defenders sent the first assault packing, but the next day the Crusaders were successful. The Byzantine emperor fled the city, and Alexios and his Crusader friends swept in. Not to the celebrations of its citizens, as he had hoped, but to the jeers of all the people of Constantinople, sounding down to him from the walls. The Crusaders sailed into the port of Constantinople, and Alexios Angelos was crowned Emperor of the Romans on the 1st of August 1203. Sir Hugh, writing to the Pope and trying his best to make his conquest of Constantinople look like it had been a good idea, reassured him of Angelos's promises. Our new emperor, with everything that he had promised us fully and completely rendered, bound himself to us by oath to cross the sea with us in next March's voyage, accompanied by 10,000 soldiers, and to provide food for 1 year to the entire army of the Lord. The actual situation was much different. When the previous emperor fled the city, he had taken with him more than 1,000 pounds of gold and some priceless jewels, leaving the imperial treasury drastically depleted. Clearly getting a little nervous about his new friends, Alexios gave leave for the Latin soldiers to take any priceless works of Byzantine art that they could find in the city's churches, outraging the city's people. These artifacts were destroyed, and their gold melted down. But even then, Angelos barely made a dent in the sum he had promised the Latin warriors. Riots broke out in the city, and, frustrated by their inability to fight with Muslims in the Holy Land, the Crusaders began destroying Constantinople's mosques instead. But the city had not earned its reputation as the refuge of strangers for nothing. Its residents came out in force to protect their Muslim neighbors. In retaliation, the Crusaders set the city ablaze, and the riots soon spiraled into a full-blown revolution against the new emperor Alexios. He was swiftly overthrown by a rebel leader named Doukas and strangled in early February 1204. The Crusaders demanded that this new emperor Doukas honor the debt that had been promised to them. When he refused, they embarked on a campaign of revenge and destruction that saw the city ravaged over 3 days of blood and fire. The Crusaders systematically violated the city's holy sanctuaries, destroying or stealing all they could lay hands on. Thousands of Constantinople's civilian population were massacred. The famous bronze horses from the Hippodrome were torn down and sent back to adorn the facade of St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, where they remain to this day. Other statues were melted down to make bronze coins, about which Nicetas Coniates quips, "Thus great things were exchanged for small ones." Declaring a victory for Christendom, the Crusaders selected a new emperor from among their own ranks, and divided the territory of the Byzantine Empire into various new Crusader states. What followed was a period of Latin rule in Constantinople, which lasted for the next 60 years or so. But the Latins soon found that governing this large and fractious empire was no easy matter. They lost one territory after another, until what was now called the Latin Empire was reduced to no more than the city of Constantinople. The last Latin emperor of Constantinople was Baldwin II, a man who would become known as Baldwin the Broke due to his incessant money problems. He was even forced to sell some of the city's priceless Christian relics to keep the state running, including the supposed crown of thorns from Jesus' crucifixion. He was eventually ousted from his throne by a Byzantine lord, and much of modern Greece and the Asian territories returned to the empire. But it was now a much diminished throne, and Constantinople a much diminished city. Over the decades since its sack, the population of Constantinople had barely recovered. By the end of the reign of Baldwin the Broke, the city was little more than a cluster of villages inside the ancient walls, separated by overgrown wasteland, fields, and crumbling ruins. Even in the still populated parts of the city, Constantinople must have been an eerie place. A century later, it would contain no more than 35,000 people, barely a tenth of the number it had been built to house. Its wide avenues and spice markets, its fairs and perfumeries, must have been virtually empty, silent and cold, as packs of dogs wandered through the lonely streets. The 14th century brought crop failures and the devastating famine of 1315, followed quickly by an even greater disaster, one that would spread to every corner of Europe, the Black Death. The Greek writer Nikephoros Gregoras wrote about the horrifying effects of this disease on Constantinople around 1346. It lasted for that whole year, passing through and destroying the continental coast, towns as well as country areas. The prominent signs of this disease, signs indicating early death, were tumorous outgrowths at the roots of thighs and arms, and simultaneously bleeding ulcerations, which sometimes the same day carried the infected rapidly out of this present life. By the 14th century, the Byzantine Empire had begun to look remarkably like its Western twin, nearly 1,000 years before. The plague exacerbated its economic problems, and destructive civil wars broke out that fatally drained the empire's manpower and resources. In 1343, the Empress Dowager, known as Anna of Savoy, even took the drastic measure of pawning the empire's crown jewels to the Venetians in exchange for funds to fight her wars. The emperors now ruled under a shoddy construction of gilded leather and cut glass, a sad symbol of how far the fortunes of the empire had slumped. Perhaps luckily for the Byzantines, their rivals were also suffering. While it mostly avoided the ravages of the plague, the Seljuk Empire was shattered by the arrival of the Mongol armies of Genghis Khan, and its territories were divided into a number of small Mongol client states known as beyliks. But with the withdrawal of the Mongols, one of these states would soon expand to absorb the others and regather some of the power that the Seljuks had once held. This state was led by a Turkish tribal leader named Osman, who would give his name to this new rising power. It would become known as the Ottoman, and its rise would spell the true end of Byzantium. The Ottoman rise to power in Anatolia is wreathed in legend, and it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction. But it's clear that they had great diplomatic skill and the ability to raise large numbers of troops. Within 90 years of the first establishment of the Ottoman Beylik, the Byzantine Empire had once again lost all its Asian territories to this new power. which now extended its ambitions across the Hellespont and onto the shores of Europe. In 1354, a powerful earthquake struck, and the Byzantine fortress at Gallipoli, on the European side of the waters, was all but destroyed. The Ottoman Sultan chose his moment to strike, crossing the water and seizing the area, quickly fortifying it. This was the Ottomans' first foothold in Europe, and their presence would only grow as the 14th and 15th centuries wore on. Soon they would form a pincer around the city of Constantinople, and only its formidable walls stood between it and capture. Aghast, the Western Latin powers put together a number of crusades in an attempt to halt the Ottoman conquests in Europe. In exchange for this help, the Eastern Church was forced to submit to the authority of the Pope. While some thought this a temporary measure to stave off the Muslim immediate threat, others saw it as a kind of cultural suicide. In response, one Byzantine admiral named Lucas Notaras is even supposed to have thundered, "I would rather see a Turkish turban in the midst of the city than the Latin mitre." To many, it must have seemed that Byzantium had now pawned away not just its relics, its crown jewels and its famous works of art, but also its soul. To add insult to injury, this spiritual compromise achieved very little. The Crusade of Nicopolis in 1396 was utterly routed by Ottoman forces. Half a century later, the Crusade of Varna met with an even more crushing defeat. These efforts distracted the Ottomans for some time, but their abject failures discouraged Western kings from sending any more aid to the dying empire of Byzantium. The man who would finally topple the empire that had lasted for 1,000 years was born in 1432. He was an Ottoman king known to history as Mehmed the Conqueror. Mehmed had inherited an empire that held territory across much of what is today Turkey, as well as in Greece and Bulgaria. But Constantinople was the one territory in the midst of all this land that he couldn't yet lay claim to. At the age of 21 in 1453, Mehmed decided to take his chances. But Constantinople, although reduced, was still a formidable target. It was guarded by only about 10,000 soldiers, but its triple line of land walls, built nearly 1,000 years before, had never been breached. Mehmed's first step was to cut off the city and take control of the Bosphorus. But he knew that to bring down those walls, his armies would need a weapon of a size and power that the world had never before seen. To help him in this task, he hired the services of a radical Hungarian engineer named Orban. Mehmed asked Orban if he could build a cannon that would bring down the walls of Constantinople. Orban replied, "I have examined the walls of the city in great detail. I can shatter to dust not only these walls with the stones from my gun, but the very walls of Babylon itself." The young sultan was impressed and gave Orban everything he asked for. 3 months later, he completed a cannon called Basilica, at the time the largest gun ever built. It was over 10 meters long, and weighed so much that it had to be dragged to the walls of Constantinople by a team of 60 oxen and 400 men, along with 70 smaller guns, which edged towards the city at a rate of only 4 kilometers a day. Slowly, Constantinople's death drew near. When the Sultan arrived at the city on the 2nd of April 1453, the Monday after Easter, he began the siege with a fearsome bombardment. Basilica was horrifically inaccurate, but when it landed a hit, the destruction it caused was immense. Iron cannonballs had yet to be developed, and so the cannon hurled smooth balls of marble or granite, each weighing 3/4 of a ton, a distance of more than a mile at the walls of Constantinople. Due to the immense amount of explosive used, the cannon had to be cooled with olive oil between shots. We can imagine the sweating Ottoman workmen toiling around this bronze monster, the air wavering above its superheated sides, the sizzle of oil and the sharp smell of gunpowder as each enormous plume of smoke burst from its gaping mouth. The bombardment went on for 48 days, with repeated attempts by the Turks to storm the city. But even under this fearsome assault, the walls held. The siege of Constantinople is one of those historical events that has passed into legend, and its details are familiar to anyone with knowledge of military history. The fighting on the water, the defenders waiting for Venetian reinforcements that never came, the Turkish sappers digging tunnels under the walls, which the Byzantines always discovered, Sultan Mehmed's daring surprise plan to carry his boats over land on wooden rollers and into the waters of the Golden Horn past its long chain. During the siege, prayers were held daily in the Hagia Sophia, the austere chanting of the Byzantine monks soaring out over the imprisoned city. Cannon fire would have rolled outside the city like a thunderstorm, interspersed by the firecracker sounds of the smaller guns popping in the distance. The psychological toll of the bombardment must have been immense. As the mood inside the city darkened and food grew short, panic set in among its inhabitants. Niccolò Barbaro, a Venetian visiting Constantinople at the time, remembered the appearance of ominous signs in the sky overhead on the 22nd of May. At the first hour after sunset, the moon rose, being at this time at the full, so that it should have risen in the form of a complete circle, but it rose as if it were no more than a 3-day moon, with only a little of it showing. The moon stayed in this form for about 4 hours. When we Christians and the pagans had seen this marvelous sign, the emperor of Constantinople was greatly afraid, and so were all his nobles, because the Greeks had a prophecy which said that Constantinople would never fall until the full moon should give a sign. Barbaro notes the increasing panic among the commanders of the army too. Juan Zustignan, that Genoese of Genoa, decided to abandon his post and fled to his ship which was lying at the boom. And as he fled, he went through the city crying, "The Turks have got into the city." When the people heard their captain's words that the Turks had got into the city, they all began to take flight and all abandoned their posts at once and went rushing towards the harbour in the hope of escaping in the ships and galleys. Finally, the time came. The Turkish soldiers, the elite janissaries of the Ottoman Sultan, burst over the walls. Barbaro recalls the sound and fury. After being driven back from the barbicans, the Turks again fired their great cannon, and the pagans like hounds came on behind the smoke of the cannon, raging and pressing on each other like wild beasts, so that in the space of 1/4 hour, there were more than 30,000 Turks inside the barbicans, with such cries that it seemed a very inferno, and the shouting was heard as far away as Anatolia. Just like the soldiers of the Fourth Crusade 200 years before, the Ottomans rampaged through the city, and the bloodshed was tremendous. Although with the city's reduced population, the casualties were much lower than before. It's said that when the Sultan Mehmed stepped into the smoking ruins of the ancient palace of Bucolion, built by Emperor Theodosius in the 5th century, he uttered 2 lines by the famous Persian poet Sadi Shirazi, who had himself seen the devastation of the Mongol invasions. The spider weaves the curtains in the palace of the Caesars. The owl calls the watches in the towers of Afrasiab. The Byzantine Empire had lasted for 1,123 years and 18 days. But now the great liturgy that had echoed from the dome of the Hagia Sophia fell silent. For many of the city's beleaguered inhabitants, its conquest was a trauma from which they could never successfully heal. The painful truth of history was converted into legend. One story concerned the priests who had been preaching in the Hagia Sophia when the city fell. Instead of being massacred, the legend says, they had in fact melted into the south wall of the sanctuary, and when the city was back in Christian hands, they would return and take up their service at the point when they had been interrupted. Another story holds that, rather than perishing in battle, the last emperor was turned into marble by an angel and waits in a cave below the Golden Horn to one day return in triumph. Nicetas Coniates, upon seeing the devastation of the city, wrote the following lament. As we left the city behind, I threw myself just as I was on the ground and reproached the walls. If what you were built to protect is no more, for what purpose do you still stand? What shall become of us? Whither shall we go? What consolation shall we find in our nakedness, torn from thy bosom as from a mother's womb? As its people told these stories, Mehmed the Conqueror moved his imperial capital to Constantinople, and a great cultural shift took place. Turkish people now settled in large numbers in Byzantium, but the city would leave just as indelible a mark on its conquerors. Indeed, Mehmed II would long claim that the Ottoman Empire was a continuation of the Roman Empire, not an end to it. He gave himself the title of Caesar and allowed the Byzantine Church to continue functioning. In his palace, he collected a library, which included works in Greek, Persian, and Latin, and gathered Greek scholars at his court. He even invited a Venetian painter to come and paint his portrait. Byzantium left its mark, too, on the religion of Islam. The crescent moon had been the symbol of the Byzantine Empire since as early as 670 BCE, in honor of the Greeks' patron goddess Artemis, the hunter. After the capture of Constantinople, Mehmed adopted it for his own banner, changing it slightly into a waxing moon, as it had been on the day of the city's conquest. This crescent would become the official standard of the Ottoman Empire, and by the 20th century had become recognized internationally as the official symbol of Islam. As Constantinople fell, the city that had once accepted refugees from all corners of the world now sent its own people streaming across Europe. And wherever they went, Byzantine refugees brought with them the ancient learnings of the Greeks, of Demosthenes and Xenophon, Thucydides, the dialogues of Plato, Aeschylus and Homer, and the works of Polybius, Appian and Cassius Dio. In 1488, some 30 years after the fall of Constantinople, Dimitrios Chalcokondylos published the first Greek book to be printed in Florence, a printed edition of the Iliad and Odyssey. Many of the classical sources referred to in this book have only survived because they were copied down in the libraries of Byzantium. Edward Gibbon once summarized the seismic effect this had on European learning. The restoration of the Greek letters in Italy was prosecuted by a series of emigrants who were destitute of fortune and endowed with learning. The natives of Thessalonica and Constantinople escaped to a land of freedom, curiosity, and wealth, and taught their native language in the schools of Florence and Rome. Those refugees would tutor scholars like the humanist philosopher Marsilio Ficino and the Italian poet Poliziano in Florence. The Medici family of Italy became patrons of one Byzantine lecturer, establishing the Platonic Academy of Florence. The fall of Byzantium sowed the seeds of what would become the European Renaissance. And as one age ended, another began. The fall of Byzantium disrupted long-established trade routes that joined Europe to Asia along the Silk Road, forcing European traders to search for new routes to the markets of the East and develop maritime technologies. Within 40 years of the siege of Constantinople, European explorers rounded the southernmost cape of Africa, opening up the sea route to India. And just a few years later, their desire to find a western route to Asia would lead to the discovery of the Americas. Christopher Columbus had been inspired to undertake his voyage, in part because of the ancient Greek text known as the Geographia, written by the philosopher Claudius Ptolemy, which had been preserved in the libraries of Byzantium and brought to Western Europe after its fall. Byzantium would also continue to welcome the tired and huddled masses of the world to shelter behind its walls. In 1492, the same year that Columbus discovered Hispaniola, European anti-Semitism reached fever pitch, and the Jews of Spain were expelled by the royal Alhambra decree. Sultan Bayezid II, the eldest son of Mehmed the Conqueror, dispatched the Ottoman navy to escort the Jews safely to his lands, where they could settle. For another generation at least, the city of Constantinople would earn the title that once emblazoned its name in the European imagination: Refuge of Strangers, Queen of the Queens of Cities. For the longest time, the memory of Byzantium has been buried, not only beneath the streets of modern Istanbul, but in the study of history too. The 18th century writer Montesquieu described the Byzantine Empire as a tragic epilogue to the glory of Rome, and European Enlightenment thinkers overwhelmingly shared this view, seeing it as a relic of the past, unchanging and static, that had played little part in the history of Europe. The modern Turkish author Orhan Pamuk, in his 2005 memoir, Istanbul, Memories and the City, writes about how the memory of Byzantium has been lost. Like most Istanbul Turks, I had little interest in Byzantium as a child. I associated the word with spooky, bearded, black-robed Greek Orthodox priests. To me, these were remnants of an age so distant that there was little need to know about it. As for the Byzantines, they had vanished into thin air, or so I'd been led to believe. No one had told me that it was their grandchildren's grandchildren's grandchildren who now ran the shoe stores, patisseries, and haberdashery shops of Beyoğlu. Today, the ruins of the Theodosian walls of Constantinople still trace their battered and crumbling route from the Sea of Marmara to the Golden Horn, through the modern city of Istanbul. These walls serve as a testament to the power of the people who turned the remnants of Rome into a flourishing and stable empire, a wellspring of art and culture, and a repository of the knowledge of the ancients that would pass its wealth on to the generations that came after. They stand as a symbol of the empire that never truly died, but lives on today, ingrained in the fabric of the cultures of both East and West, Christian and Muslim, and reaching back down the ages, from the time of the ancients to the dawn of a new world.